It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Holy crap, the Mets won a game. Welcome to Rico Bronya. Episode number 683, minutes after the Mets win on the West Coast against the Angels of Anaheim, coming back from 3-0 down, taking a 4-3 lead, and unlike what happened on Thursday afternoon, nobody in the bullpen gives up a two-run home run, and they don't lose 5-4. The Mets win, and there are actually some positive things to talk about, because even though the Mets are now 11-21 and still have a lot of work to do as they try to climb back towards 500 and try to get out of last place and try to get themselves in some semblance of a postseason race, there were actually some things that can make you smile late on a Friday night in Southern California. First of all, if you invested time watching this game, congratulations. You know, I've heard from so many Met fans over the last 48 hours that after the loss on Thursday, after the non-firing of Carlos Mendoza, basically they were giving up and saying, I can't watch this team anymore. And it would be easy on a Friday night West Coast game against the Angels to say, I'm out. And maybe some of you were. Maybe some of you are getting your Met information by listening to this Rico Bronya. Well, thank you. This did not start out well. This felt like a typical Met loss. Everything about it. Christian Scott, making his second major league start of the season, actually didn't get off to the worst start because he didn't walk the ballpark. He actually struck out two of the first three hitters he faced. The only guy he didn't get out was Mike Trout. And then he made one mistake. And he hung a curveball to old friend Jorge Soler. And so instantly, this team is down 2-0. That's negative number one. And negative number two is the offense was not showing a pulse in the first three innings against Walbert Urania. They go down 1-2-3 in the first inning. They go down 1-2-3 in the second inning. They get a one-out walk in the third inning that very, very quickly gets erased by a Ronnie Mauricio double play. And then, in typical Met fashion, this is why this game does have some satisfaction, because there was so much bad over the first 5.5 innings. There were no signs that the Mets were actually going to win. So you combine the runs they give up early on the Soler home run off of Christian Scott. They go down meekly over the first three innings. And then in the fourth inning, and this was so frustrating to watch, Bo Bichette leadoff hit. Juan Soto draws a walk in which he's trying to lay down a bunt, which, you know, I'm not big on Juan Soto bunting. I've killed it. At this point, this is how jaded this Met team has made me. I want base runners so badly that, fine, lay down a bunt. You know, whatever. But he draws a walk. And with two on and nobody out in a game that is now 3-0, you have to walk away with a run. You don't have to get it all back like you did on Thursday afternoon. But you got to get a run. You got to take this 3-0 deficit and make it 3-1. Make it 3-2. You still have a lot of innings to play with. You have two on and nobody out with 3, 4, 5 of the order coming up. You have to walk away with something. And MJ Melendez strikes out. Francisco Alvarez strikes out. Brett Beatty draws the easiest walk ever because Urania couldn't throw him a strike. And then you get this Marcus Semien at bat in the fourth inning. And, you know, they flash the numbers that Simeon's numbers with runners in scoring position have actually been pretty good. It doesn't feel that way. And I'd have to do a deep dive on why it doesn't feel that way. I don't think it's just me giving you a feeling. I think that it hasn't been impactful. And a lot of times, you know, the way we are as fans is, great, you got a hit in a 9-1 game with runners in scoring position. It doesn't feel the same as compared to all the big opportunities you come up with. And this was a big opportunity for Marcus Semien. Like I mentioned, you had two on and nobody out, and you needed to walk away with a run. And because of the back-to-back strikeouts of Melendez and Alvarez, it looked like they weren't going to walk away with anything. And Marcus Semien works the full count, and he flies out to right field. Nice little running play by Joe Adell. So considering the offense either does nothing or puts two on and nobody out and can't score. Christian Scott gives up two runs before your ass can be comfortable in the seat. And then the third run he gives up was all because of bad defense. He hits the leadoff hitter, which obviously creates trouble when he drilled Zach Neto the way he did. Steals second, steals third, and on the steal of third, Francisco Alvarez throws it in the left field. And I know, because I know the way you're thinking, when Alvarez made that throw in a left field, combined with the fact that Francisco Alvarez has done very little at the plate, though he would do something later, which we'll get to, wasn't there this sense of just start Luis Torrens? I'm sure many Met fans thought that, because the one thing Luis Torrens will not do, he may bounce into double plays, he may not give you a lot of offensive production, but he ain't throwing that ball in the left field. He's not handing the Angels a third run. And when you have an offense like the New York Mets, three runs feels, it feels daunting. It feels like something you're not going to come back from. So think about where we are five innings into this game. We've got Christian Scott giving up a quick home run. We've got the defense just handing the Angels a third run. Just here, take it. Just take the third run. And then you've got the offense basically doing everything it normally does, either getting mowed down or putting together a rally and having that rally go absolutely nowhere. If you didn't turn the game off in the sixth inning, you were doing what I was doing watching this game, going through the motions. That's how I felt. West Coast game. It's after 10 o'clock. I was very much consumed by the NBA tonight. The Piston Magic game is still stunning the crap out of me. For those that didn't see it, I'll mix in like 10 seconds of the NBA. Orlando in a closeout game is the 8 seed, had a 24-point lead. And not only did the Pistons come back, they came back on the Magic like they were standing still. And it actually turned into a blowout the other way. So I'm consumed by the NBA. I start the Met game. I'm watching it, obviously. But as they go down 2-0 and 3-0 and the offense does nothing, I'm like watching this game in a coma state, because I just know they're going to lose. But sometimes, and this is the beauty of baseball, sometimes when you least expect it, weird bleep happens. And in the top of the sixth inning of this game, when Bo Bichette hits the line drive off of Wilbert Urania, who the Mets could not hit in this game, give the kid credit. We obviously don't know a lot about him other than the handful of major league starts he's made. He has only made, coming into this game, two major league starts, so I'm not going to get nuts about his stats or his ERA. He'd only thrown 11 and a third major league innings until this start. And he threw hard, and he was impressive. But everyone's impressive against the Mets. When Bo Bichette lines a base hit off of the body of Urania and he goes down to the ground, it was like a mini opportunity. But even with Urania coming out of the game and Brent Suter coming in, think about all the crappy pitchers that have shut the Mets down. Think about what the Nationals just did 2 days ago or yesterday or the day. I'm lost on time at this point. The Thursday afternoon game. It's not as if they came out with these legendary relievers to shut them down. You know, Mitchell Parker ain't going into the Hall of Fame. Gus Varland ain't going in the Hall of Fame. And God knows Dickie Lovelady ain't going in the Hall of Fame. But nevertheless, it was an opportunity. And Juan Soto, who has been an on-base machine, ground ball through the hole. Here we are again. We're all set up. Just like we were set up in the fourth inning with two on and nobody out. And then we've got the Mendy special. MJ Melendez, who is 0-for-2 so far. I wasn't even going to say it, like he's quieted off, because it was only three at-bats prior when he hit the three-run home run, which felt like a significant hit on Thursday afternoon to maybe turn this season around. But there's a lefty on the mound in Suter. And I knew Mendy was going to pinch hit for him. Now, we all knew it. I don't think there was any way, two on, nobody out, down by three in the sixth inning, he was going to let Melendez hit. If it was a two-run game, maybe you let him bunt, but obviously down by three runs, that's not an option. Here's my quibble with the manager. I get pinch hitting for MJ Melendez in this spot. A little bit different. But I wouldn't have done it with a 160 hitter in Austin Slater that you picked off the scrap heap. If you're going to do it, I think you do it with Mark Vientos. And I am certainly no lover at this point of Mark Vientos, but you've got four right-handed bats on the bench. Andy Ibañez, who they recently claimed off waivers and just added to the roster. Eric Wagaman, we barely knew ye. Austin Slater, Luis Torrens, and Mark Vientos. Down by three in the sixth inning, if you agree that you're going to put a right-handed bat out there against Sutter, isn't Vientos the best option? And again, I'm just comparing it to the other options. I'm not saying it's the greatest option, but if my choice, and it is, it's Vientos, Torrens, Slater, Ibañez, or just letting MJ Melendez hit, Vientos is probably your best option. But he goes to Austin Slater, and of course he strikes out. Of course. But major props to Francisco Alvarez, because as bad as his bat has been recently, he gets that double in the ninth inning on Thursday, which could have led to something. It didn't. But the RBI single was not only huge to get the Mets on the scoreboard, but it came on an 0-2 pitch. A really impressive piece of hitting by Francisco Alvarez. And then you get the Marcus Semien moment after Beatty grounds it out. 3-1, second, third, two outs. Now you're facing Chase Silseth. Marcus Semien needed to come through. And it has felt like he hasn't most of the season. Don't give me the numbers. Watching him all year, he doesn't feel like he's come through with that many big hits. And again, much like Alvarez, behind in the count, pounds one up the middle for a base hit. And I was out of my coma state. That base hit got me out of my coma state. I got my 9-year-old sleeping on the couch. I got all these games on. Been watching this game in a coma state. But when Semien bounced that ball up the middle, I was pumped up. It was a rare pumped up moment for a Met fan these days. Because it was clutch and it was unexpected. You know, when they came back on Thursday down 3-0, that was unexpected, but it was early in the game. This is the sixth inning of a West Coast game in which they're on their way to having a rally go kind of nowhere. They did get the run on the board, but now it's the sixth inning. It's not the fourth inning. You got to get more than one run on the board. And I didn't think they would come back. I didn't think Marcus Semien, especially falling behind Silseth 0-2 the way he did, and if memory serves correct, he chased a couple of sliders low and away. I didn't think there was any shot he was coming through. So that was a cool moment. It's nice to have a cool moment because all we've watched is horrific moments this season. But after that, you need to win. And hopefully Ronnie Mauricio's game-winning home run in the seventh inning, which was a bomb, hopefully it can be big for two reasons. Obviously, this game turned out to be the game-winning home run, breaking the tie one inning later. But hopefully it gets them going. This is the biggest opportunity and the most straight-lined opportunity that Ronnie Mauricio has ever had. When he came up late in 2023, it was brief. He obviously gets hurt. Non-factor in 24, and he never had a straight line opportunity in 2025. What I mean by straight line opportunity is, dude, it's your job, go play. Not, hey, hopefully you're hot for a week, and then maybe we'll find out bats for you. This is a straight line chance for Ronnie Mauricio as the shortstop of this team. Francisco Lindor is not walking through that door anytime soon. I don't think the Mets prefer to play Bo Bichette at shortstop. I don't either. This is your job. And this home run, which ended in 0-for-12, 0-for-13, whatever it was big. And hopefully it leads to something. I'm not telling you it will. I just hope it does. Because this is his chance to prove he can be a regular, everyday major leaguer. So what do I think of the offense? Look, they had 9 innings in this game, and they failed to score in 7 of them, which is very typical. But luckily, due to some brilliant pitching, the 4 runs, the 3 in the 6th, the 1 in the 7th on the Mauricio home run was enough. It's about time it was enough. Because on Thursday, we hoped it was enough until Luke Weaver blew the game. And on Friday night, it turned out to be enough because this bullpen, following Christian Scott, who I thought was pretty good, but this bullpen did a marvelous job. Brazoban, Raleigh, Weaver, and even Devin Williams. Bounce back performance by Luke Weaver. Not really impressive by Waskar Brazoban, who we hadn't seen in so long. He had to go through Trout, Moncada, and Soler, and he did it rather easily. Brooks Raley was automatic, 1-2-3. And this was a nice little test for Luke Weaver. He stood there in front of the locker, told us about basically the pressures that the Mets have been going through. Nobody wants to hear it. We want to see results. Hat tip to Luke Weaver. He got the results, including getting out Zach Neto to make sure that Mike Trout didn't come up with a chance to flip the score. And Devin Williams. I don't think any of us have faith in Devin Williams, but Devin Williams needed to save this game. And this was not easy. We're talking about a 1-run game, again, facing the heart of the Angels' batting order, the same heart that Brazoban got through, Trout, Moncada, and Soler. And he made it look easy. It was kind of surreal to see the Met pitching retire, what was it, 21 in a row? Yeah, 21 in a row after the hit batsman of Neto, in which he came around and scored on the 2 stolen bases and the bad throw by Alvarez. 21 in a row. We're so used to being on the other side of that. So just outstanding pitching out of this bullpen. And I thought Christian Scott was impressive. 5 innings, 3 runs doesn't jump out at you as great, because I think, what does that add up to, like a 6 ERA or whatever it is? But I think when you look closer at this performance, he didn't walk anybody, which was such a huge jump from his first start, in which he walked 5 guys in an inning and a third. He struck out 8. His slider or sweeper, whatever he's calling it, was nasty as hell. And he went out there and I thought settled down after that big mistake. You're allowed to give up 2 runs in the first inning. It's not fun. It's not ideal to put your offense on the heels, but you can turn it into a good performance. And that third run was obviously not his fault. He made the one mistake of hitting Neto on the first pitch in the third inning, but he struck out Mike Trout and he struck out Yoan Moncada. And he got Soler to ground out. Unfortunately, the Angels turned that into a cheapy third run. But Christian Scott has earned another start. He should get that. And a really good effort by the Met bullpen. Let's read your emails. I love game night emails because we're going to go through it chronologically. So you'll hear from people who are very upset the way I admitted I was upset. You know, they're losing. They suck. They're not going to win this game. This is terrible. So let's have some fun if you're consuming this live early, early Saturday morning, or you've downloaded the Rico Bronya wherever you download your podcasts. Ryan Jones, or Ryan from Norwalk, had an observation about Christian Scott. Maybe you can tell me I'm crazy. I don't know, but I just think, and let me read this again. Sometimes my reading skills go awry at midnight. I don't know why I'm just noticing this, but Christian Scott's windup is eerily similar to Zach Wheeler, and he's wearing the same number. I'd love to know if he watched Wheeler growing up. Too bad his results aren't as good as Wheeler's, as we're already down 2 runs. He absolutely reminds me of Zach Wheeler. It's not just the number. I think it's the windup. I think it's the way he holds his glove. I even think to a degree it's his stuff. That doesn't mean he's going to be Zach Wheeler. Obviously, I just hope Christian Scott at this point is a solid major league starter. That'd be a win. Unfortunately, David Peterson never even turned into that. So, and keep this in mind about Zach Wheeler. And I think a part of why losing Wheeler hurts in such a different way than some of the other free agents over the years is that we watched him grow and we watched him struggle. Zach Wheeler had some good moments before Tommy John, like you could see him growing as a pitcher. And then he needed Tommy John, and it took him a really long time to put it all together. Christian Scott had Tommy John. He used that brace or whatever they call it. This is only his second major league start back from that. So in fairness, he may turn into Zach Wheeler. We've got a lot of time to find that out, but I think more than just the number, the windup, the way he holds his glove, the stuff, he does have some similarities to Zach Wheeler. Luis writes, the 2026 Mets are so bad, they just made me tell David Wright that no one gives an F about your hot dogs. This is a new low. I don't want to complain about that. Steve Gelbs has been doing a segment. I forget what he calls it. Let's be frank, or I'm frank, or let's all be frank. No, I think it's let's be frank. We rate these hot dogs. I don't want to get on Gelbs or the Mets for trying to have fun. It's a long-ass season. What I would tell you is I don't care about it, and it bothers me. Not that they do it, because I think doing it is fine. What I don't like is taking the attention away from the game from the camera's perspective. Like, if you and David Wright want to rank a hot dog, rank a hot dog. But when there's a challenge going on, make sure the focus is on the umpire, on the challenge call, what's going on the field. I don't need to see David Wright eat the hot dog. That's my critique of SNY and of that segment. The segment's fine, but I need to see the game. It's a visual thing. Sean writes, at some point, the Mets need to actually get a catcher. Francisco Alvarez is a backup bench catcher at best. It's been years now. The shine is gone, just like most of our other top prospects that pan out to be fringe borderline players. I'm looking at when that email was written. It was written at 10:32. So, like I mentioned, it was right as Alvarez made the bad throw. Not when Alvarez came up in the sixth, behind in the count 0-2, and actually bounced the ball up the middle for a base hit. Meller writes, Marcus Semien just had a 3-1 fastball right down the middle of the plate, and it was a foul tip. Yeah, that was the at-bat in the fourth inning with the bases loaded, which felt like such a pivotal moment in this game. Thomas writes, Evan, I've been a fan and avid listener of yours for many years. I would call in, but I'm almost always on the Odyssey app and not live, so I thought I would try to email. In the grand scheme of things, this is a funny place to start, given the dozens of times I've been tempted to reach out. I had a comment on your Curse of Jeff Kent rant on the Rico Bronya. While I love the idea and have often wondered why the Mets are where all-stars or even Hall of Fame second basemen come to die, I have to say you missed the actual start of the curse. Lenny Dykstra and Roger McDowell for Juan Samuel in 1989. Dykstra and McDowell were immensely popular, both with the fans and I think within the team. The trade was a disaster. McDowell went on to have 41 saves for the Phillies over the next 2 years, and Dykstra compiled an 810 OPS with the Phillies over 8 years. Meanwhile, Juan Samuel had a career low 590 on OPS for his 1 year with the Mets. Yes, the curse of Dykstra or McDowell, take your pick. That started it all. The only reason I go with Jeff Kent is, first of all, bias. The Juan Samuel trade was slightly before my time. But also, Lenny Dykstra turned into a tremendous player. And I think that what he turned into shouldn't have been considered a big surprise. And I don't think it was by a lot of Met fans. But as good as what Lenny Dykstra turned into, he has to buy a ticket to go to Cooperstown. Jeff Kent turned into a Hall of Famer. It's almost like a different level in a lot of ways. Now, Jeff was not beloved as a Met the way Lenny Dykstra was, but I go curse of Jeff Kent, but I respect it. I also got an emailer who was upset with me saying, how could you believe in curses? Look at the second basemans they brought in. They were all old and washed up. He's obviously right. I am not a believer in curses. I've gone on many rants about the Red Sox that there was no curse of the Bambino. Tom Yawkey was a racist. Tom Yawkey had a chance to integrate Major League Baseball and the Red Sox in the mid-40s, And I think the players he was about to sign, it was about three or four players. I think it was Josh Gibson, Jackie Robinson, Satchel Paige, and Tom Yawkey put the veto on it because he was a bigot. Now, is that a curse? No, that's incompetence or being a racist. So I am actually, in all seriousness, not a believer in curses. I think it's incompetent management. The Jets aren't cursed. They're incompetent. The Cubs weren't cursed. They were incompetent. So I say it with a wink. I'm having fun. The Mets brought in washed up second basemen. Marcus Semien had all the signs of being washed up. So to call it a curse would not be fair. Would not be fair. Mike Morin writes, Evan, I heard what you said about A.J. Ewing, but I want to know what you think of some of the other prospects in our system. Jahan Bey, Ryan Clifford, Nick Morabito. First of all, Jahan Bey is not a prospect. So let's exclude him from that. Ryan Clifford, I think, is close. He plays a lot of first base. He's played some outfield. He's got pop. Looking at his numbers over the last week or so, he has performed at a pretty high level. I think he's one of those guys we will see before the season is over. And Nick Morabito, I was calling to have called up the other day to potentially get an opportunity in center field. John from Brooklyn writes, and he sent this email at 10:50 p.m. So I would say at that point, we are right before the sixth inning rally. John writes, 0%. Don't you feel like there's literally a 0% chance of getting a hit with every single batter that comes up to the plate except for Juan Soto? Kyle writes, hi, Evan and Hoff. I'm sitting here watching the Mets like an idiot, and I'm actually laughing after every time they bat, saying to myself, it's comical how bad this team is. I can't help but watch to see if they can get any worse. The offense can't hit a guy who has pitched 11 career innings in the major leagues. It's like watching the worst movie you've ever seen, but you can't turn it off because it's so bad you need to finish it. I'm numb to losing at this point. Thank you. Well, things were about to change. So that, I mean, yes, I felt the exact same way in the moment. Carlos in San Diego writes, I'm at the game in Anaheim right now. You know how you know you suck? When you pinch hit for your number three hitter in the fifth inning. Well, it was the sixth inning, close enough. And to that point, MJ Melendez can't bat third if you're going to routinely pinch hit for him. Because now in the middle of games or late in games, your third place hitter is Austin Slater. So if you're going to continue to do this with Melendez, I think you need to hit him down in the batting order. Sean writes, Evan, can you help me understand why you would bat someone in the three hole that you need to pinch hit for in the sixth inning? Look at that. Me and Sean thinking alike. Is this really the place you want Austin Slater inserted into a lineup? 1,000%. Just said it. We think alike, Sean. If you're going to use pinch hitters for MJ Melendez, then you can't bat him third and you can't bat him fourth. Can't do it. Just can't do it. Let's go to Scott, who writes, top of the seventh, Tyrone Taylor leading off, 2-0 count, and he swings at ball three. I know it's not egregious, but as things stand, would it kill the light hitting fourth outfielder to take a strike in certain situations, like leading off an inning, a runner in scoring position? I get it, but there, it drives me nuts. Drives me nuts, too. I hate that. Be patient. Especially when you're ahead in the count like that. Paul writes, hey, Evan, my mom would like me to remind you that Marcus Semien has been the Mets' best hitter this year with runners in scoring position. She loves the Rico, but is perturbed by how much you've ragged on Simeon's offense. No doubt he's been terrible with the bases empty, but it's been a different story with runners in scoring position. Fortunately, Marcus decided to remind us of all that with his two-run single in the sixth inning. Well, I mentioned this earlier, and maybe Paul's mom is going to cause me to do this. I got to do a deep dive because they haven't been impactful. Numbers are numbers, right? I can't argue that he's been a good hitter with runners in scoring position, but it doesn't feel like someone you have faith in when they come up in a big spot. I think the reason that is, and again, I'll do the deep dive at some point. I'm going to analyze all of his at-bats with runners in scoring position. I think it's going to show you that they haven't made that big of a difference. Bill writes, Evan, you're right. Ooh, you should stop right there. I'm going to keep it short. I wanted to send this email a week ago, but Juan Soto needs to lead off. Yes, he is their best hitter, and he will get more at-bats. But as the leadoff hitter, he will protect the young kids that will get called up and batting ninth. The Mets have done so poorly developing and protecting their prospects. Why not bat Soto first, then have Mauricio or Benj bat ninth? Give these kids protection so they get the pitchers to hit and build confidence. Ideally, I wouldn't bat Soto first, but considering what's going on right now, he has to. As the young prospects get more confident, you can change the lineup around. I want him leading off because I look at this lineup and I look at Bo Bichette, who has been hitting. He had two hits in this game. And I would rather have the guy who has a far better on-base percentage be the guy that leads off for me. Sometimes it's that simple. Jeremy writes, Evan, you're wrong. Oh, look at this. We went from Evan, you're right, to Evan, you're wrong. Evan, you're wrong. The Mets season is not over. The start of the season has made me want to gouge my eyes out, but I still don't think the season is dead. Here's why. 2024, the Mets were 24-35, 89 wins in the NLCS. The Astros in 2024 were 12-24, 88 wins in the playoffs. 2024 Tigers were 39-48, 86 wins in the playoffs. 2018 Dodgers, 16-26, 92 wins and a World Series appearance. 2013 Dodgers, 30-42, 92 wins and NLCS appearance. I got to tell you, this email is making me feel good as I read it. I knew about a few of these, but boy, when you hear about them back to back to back, it's like, damn. 2022 Mariners, 25-35, 90 wins and the playoffs. 2022 Phillies, 21-29, fired manager, 87 wins, World Series World Series appearance. And of course, the 2019 Nationals, which is the most famous. Plenty of teams have recovered from being 10 games or more under 500 at much later points in the season than 11-21. To act as if the season is fully dead, in my opinion, is erroneous. Well, Jeremy, the Mets season is not dead because of their record. It never has been. When I have uttered the phrase death of a season, I haven't said it because they're 11 games out of first place. I haven't said it because they were 11 games under 500. I said it because I don't think they're good. I don't remember how I felt about a lot of those other teams, but like the 2019 Nationals, I mean, look at their rotation. Look at the talent that was on that roster. This roster doesn't feel like it has those kinds of capabilities. So I appreciate that email because there's a lot there that should make you feel good about how the math does not end the Mets season, but I don't think anyone really thinks it's the math or the burial. I think it's more the team. Tommy writes, man, Devin Williams looked filthy tonight. Hell of a win for him. I think the performance is an ego booster for him. For a guy who's said that the Pete home run kind of broke him mentally, I think this win contributed to him getting his confidence back. I want to see how he does next time. I think the Devin Williams story is going to be a good one this season. I do hope you're right. He was filthy. Major credit to him. Major credit to everybody who pitched in this game. Let's get to the Anthony DeComo story. That broke before the game tonight. I had a few minutes to talk about it on Evan and Tiki. Basically, David Stearns and Steve Cohen didn't go to Twitter. They didn't hold a press conference. They just did an article, or was quoted, Stearns was, in an article by Anthony DeComo, who writes for MLB.com, saying that Carlos Mendoza is safe, that they believe in him, that they have no intention of firing him. But there is one quote from the story that got my attention. One quote from the story that made me say, okay, that's a little bit different. I'm going to read what DeComo wrote, and I think you'll notice the thing that jumped out at me. While it's possible the Mets could change their mind regarding Mendoza much later in the season, he will be in no imminent danger of losing his job, even if the team continues to slide during a 9-game West Coast trip that opens Friday night in Anaheim. Similarly, Cohen has given Stearns at least some assurances that his own role is safe. Mets officials believe in the roster they have constructed and the process that led them to this point, even as success has not followed. I have said many times here on the RICO and on WFAN that as much as you may want to fire David Stearns, no way that's happening. That David Stearns is one of the safest executives in New York sports. That Steve Cohen waited a very long time to hire him. He's paying him a crazy amount of money, and he believes in him. And so despite the poor roster construction, and despite many of the fair critiques that I've levied at him and you guys have levied at him, I never thought his job was in jeopardy. That sentence, though, is your first crack. Cohen has given Stearns at least some assurances that his own role is safe. That feels, not that they're going to fire Stearns, but that the door has been cracked open slightly. That if this team has a horrible season, if this team loses 90-plus games, that Steve Cohen could be mad enough to say, dude, I trust you. What the hell happened? I still don't think he'll fire him for the reasons I've given. And I stand by the fact that as pissed off as I am at David Stearns, I don't like the idea of firing him. And I don't know why some people take that as a defense of him. I'm not defending him. I mean, we've gone through every move. I haven't liked a lot of it. But I think that executives, especially presidents of baseball operations, it's very different than managers. It's very different than, hey, let's try a new voice. It is a complete overhaul of an entire organization. And that doesn't mean I wouldn't get there at some point. I just don't want to get there this quickly into a new administration. But boy, Mets officials believe in the roster. But no. Cohen has given Stearns at least some assurances that his own role is safe. It reads as if the door is slightly cracked open. Very, very slightly. Bottom line is, this is a happy Rico Bronya. The Mets won a baseball game. They have a lot of work to do. They need to put together a winning streak. They need to put together a stretch of games that cuts into this deficit they've created. But Friday night, May 1st, hopefully we talk about this. Hopefully this is a date we refer back to as the date that turned the season. They were down 3. They came back. They held on. Let's see them do it again. We'll have another Rico Bronya when this series is over at some point Sunday, early evening or mid-evening. Our series recap of the Rico Bronya. Remember to download and subscribe to the Rico so you never miss an episode. And of course, you could subscribe to the WFAN YouTube page, and then you could get your Rico Bronyas live. LGM, thank you for listening to a happy edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.